Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
You want a full PFD? You want a half PFD, a 50-50 PFD? You got to fix oil taxes.
The Alaska Senate settles on a $1,000 PFD as they pass a budget bill to the House. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 7th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Republicans in Congress stay silent as Democrats object to new oil leasing in Anwar.
We should be voting to permanently protect this special place rather than auctioning it off to the highest bidder.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. A bill advancing in Congress would mandate new oil lease sales in Alaska's Arctic and allow construction of the Ambler Road. Republicans on the U.S. House Natural Resources Committee approved those items early today as part of a budget reconciliation bill. Alaska Congressman Nick Begich claimed the win, but as Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports, he and other Republicans were nearly silent as the bill was up for consideration.
Democrats tried to defeat significant portions of the bill with more than 100 amendments. The first would have removed the requirement to hold oil lease sales in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and killed all chances of drilling there ever.
We should be voting to permanently protect this special place rather than auctioning it off to the highest bidder. I yield back.
That was the top Democrat on the committee, Congressman Jared Huffman of California. In response, Republicans said nothing, or almost nothing.
Make an announcement for the committee.
Committee Chairman Bruce Westerman of Arkansas had something to say about sandwiches.
Assume we'll have lunch in the back. We're not going to recess for lunch, but if you want to go have lunch, you can go in the back room and have lunch.
That's how it went through more than 100 amendments. Democrats tried taunting with statements that usually get a rise out of the other side. They cajoled. Nothing they did could get Republicans on the committee to debate them. Begich, like other Republicans, sat calmly, scrolling on his phone or leafing through papers. It was a strategy, and they stuck with it. Democrats say Republicans wanted to avoid debating policy so that the bill wouldn't get derailed in the Senate. A reconciliation bill is special because senators can't filibuster it. But to qualify, all the components have to be about revenue and spending. The silent treatment had another benefit. The proceedings moved along faster. Still, it was after midnight when the committee passed the bill by a vote of 26 to 17. One Democrat voted for it. Ethan Manuel watched some of the proceedings. He's director of public land protection for the Sierra Club and has observed this committee hold Arctic refuge debates, many of them fiery, since 1998.
This one feels weirder and worse.
There used to be Republicans and Democrats on both sides of the debate. Now, Manuel says, there's less independent thought in Congress and more partisan dictates. It was clear from the start, Manuel says, that all the Democratic amendments would fail. And they did. Begich did not respond to an interview request. His office issued a statement calling the bill a victory for Alaska and for American energy independence. In addition to the Arctic refuge provisions, the bill mandates lease sales in the National Petroleum Reserve and in Cook Inlet. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski and two other senators, Democrats Jeff Merkley of Oregon and Brian Schatz of Hawaii, have demanded urgent action from the Secretary of Health and Human Services. In a letter to Robert Kennedy Jr., they say the Indian Health Service is unable to deliver quality health care services to American Indian and Alaska Native people as required by federal law. The senators said staffing shortages and a civilian hiring freeze have made matters worse for an already struggling system. They say not only are medical services in jeopardy, but also billing, appointments, lab work, and other essential tasks, even accreditation for IHS facilities. In their letter, the senators also called on Kennedy to halt any further cutbacks without first engaging in meaningful tribal consultation, which has not taken place. They cited a high mortality rate from most major health issues comparable to what the general U.S. population experienced in 1944. The Alaska Senate approved its version of the state budget today. It includes a $1,000 permanent fund dividend, and for now, a slight surplus. But senators say they expect that surplus to evaporate, and they're warning of tough times in the years ahead, as Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports.
It's telling that much of the debate about this year's budget revolves around what's in store for next year.
If by some miracle oil prices jump next year, it's going to be a lot worse next year.
It's clear to me that the decisions next year will be even more difficult than the decisions that we have made today.
You heard there from Republican Senators Rob Myers and Mike Kronk, as well as Senator Lyman Hoffman. He's a Bethel Democrat and the Senate's chief budgeter. Hoffman pointed to stiff headwinds buffeting the state's revenue. The biggest, of course, is oil prices. They're lower than lawmakers expected and not looking like they'll improve in a meaningful way anytime soon. Even expanded drilling likely won't help in the near future, given the way the state's tax code works. Another is federal spending. The federal government is the biggest single source of state revenue, roughly half the state budget.
The state's budget has over $6 billion in federal revenues that help pay for many services, from Medicaid, heating assistance, to fish and game research and K-12 education.
Even a small cut to federal spending would leave the budget reeling, and Congress and President Donald Trump aren't exactly suggesting small cuts. So there was, as there always is, debate over how big the permanent fund dividend should be. $1,000 would be the lowest inflation-adjusted dividend in state history. Even Hoffman says it's too little. But the debate was a little half-hearted. There were the standard attempts to raise the dividend to the $3,800 amount set in state law and to the 50-50 system Governor Mike Dunleavy proposed a few years ago. Senate Minority Leader Mike Schauer, a Wasilla Republican, proposed and quickly withdrew amendments that would raise the dividend. He says he largely did it for the folks watching at home, but he acknowledged that the lean times now and to come made it unrealistic.
This is not forgotten, and we understand it's there. The headwinds of the fiscal situation and other things are changing that dynamic at the moment.
The one dividend amendment that did come to a vote, a Schauer proposal to boost it to $1,500, failed by a wide margin. With all the dire warnings of lean times again, there was also plenty of debate about how the state should fix its structural budget issues. There were calls from, among others, Democratic Anchorage Senator Bill Wilkowski to expand state revenue.
We are not following our constitutional obligation to get the maximum value for our resources. You want a full PFD? You want a half PFD, a 50-50 PFD? You got to fix oil taxes.
And there were calls from others, including Schauer, to return to negotiations on a long-term fiscal plan, including an expansion of taxes and ways to keep government spending in check, like a spending cap.
Part of why we are here is because we haven't enacted enough of that yet to get enough of us to the center to move it off the table by doing it.
There was even a rebuke of the governor's budget proposal, which included a $3,800 dividend that would have drained half of the state's savings, from Wasilla Republican Senator Rob Yutt. He represents a lot of the same constituents that Dunleavy himself once represented during his time in the legislature.
I cannot wrap my mind around walking into my house and dropping a budget on my wife's desk that's $1.5 billion upside down on day one. It shouldn't even be legal.
Hoffman says it was a Herculean task to construct a balanced budget, giving all of the state's headwinds, and he says he's not happy with the budget's cuts to key programs, from child care to corrections.
We all wish we could provide all the services that every Alaskan desires, but that is not reality. The bottom line is our constituents want and deserve more.
At the end of it, though, he says lawmakers had no choice. The budget passed 16-4 with votes from all of the bipartisan majority caucus and two minority Republicans who said they were glad their voices were heard in the Senate Finance Committee. Now it goes back to the House, which will likely vote to set up a conference committee to craft a final budget. Lawmakers have until midnight on May 21st to take a final vote. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
A man who went missing in Fairbanks 5 months ago was found dead last week. Fairbanks police confirmed on Monday that the state medical examiner's office positively identified a body found within city limits as 21-year-old Devin Standifer. They said that no foul play is suspected in his death. Community members had been searching for Standifer since he vanished on the night of December 7th last year after a physical altercation. Standifer's case led to at least one organized protest in Fairbanks over frustrations with the high rates of missing and murdered indigenous people across the U.S. Others voiced their concerns on social media that local law enforcement had neglected Standifer's case. Sandy Koyakuk, Standifer's grandmother, said she wanted to thank all the people who helped spread the word about her missing grandson, even total strangers.
I would just like to recognize the people, the outpouring support. You know, there's people all through the nation. We have people that we don't even know that's been there for us. And I would like to thank everyone from all our family. We do appreciate that. There's so many, I just can't remember their names right now.
The day before Standifer disappeared, he had been named a person of interest in a sexual assault case at the residence where he was last seen. Fairbanks police identified him as a suspect in the assault, but he was never charged with a crime. The Fairbanks Police Department did not respond to requests for further comments on the case. The medical examiner's toxicology report has not been returned. The Alaska Supreme Court has taken up a case questioning whether cities can be held liable for emergency services provided outside city limits. And as KNOM's Ben Townsend tells us, the case sets an important precedent for rural communities across the state.
The case centered around a 2019 vehicle accident that occurred about 35 miles outside of city limits. According to the opinion, plaintiff John Rochon suffered serious injuries after being ejected from a vehicle and was later transported by emergency responders to the hospital. Rochon alleged that the city of Nome and an EMT were negligent in their rescue efforts. The opinion, issued Friday, said that three EMTs held Rochon on a backboard rather than securing him with straps. Rochon claimed this worsened his injuries as the ambulance navigated the 35-mile drive back to town on a gravel road. The city argued that it was immune from liability under Alaska state law, which protects municipalities and their employees from lawsuits stemming from the gratuitous extension of municipal services on an extraterrestrial basis, because the ambulance service was provided outside of city limits. Rochon contended that because he was billed nearly $2,000, that the service could not be considered gratuitous. However, the Supreme Court sided with the city, affirming that gratuitous in this context means services provided without legal obligation, not necessarily without cost. Chief Justice Susan Carney wrote that, quote, defining gratuitous as without legal obligation is consistent with this legislative purpose to encourage municipalities to be good Samaritans and provide services that they are not required to provide. She went on to say that, quote, unless a municipality has entered a contract otherwise, it generally has no duty to provide emergency or other services beyond its borders. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Townsend.
The Anchorage School District plans to reinstate nearly 300 employees that were previously slated to be displaced. At a school board meeting Tuesday, the board unanimously approved a budget revision to spend nearly $40 million in expected revenue from a bill the legislature passed that would increase state funding to schools. The Anchorage School Board passed a budget in February that cut 380 positions, but the district, which is the largest in the state, delayed layoffs for many employees. Board member Pat Higgins said even with the increase, the district will continue to face massive budget deficits in the years ahead.
Unless the legislature and the governor decide that their obligation is to fund adequately public education, we're going to do this again next year.
The current bill would increase the base student allocation by $700, but at a committee meeting last week, board members opted only to budget for a $560 per student increase, and that's a figure Governor Mike Dunleavy has proposed. School board members said last week they based their budget amendment off Dunleavy's proposed increase because of a lack of trust in the legislature to override the governor if he vetoes the bill. Board President Carl Jacobs said the dire fiscal situation Alaska school districts face should be a wake-up call for legislators.
Our system of funding public education right now is broken, and that is because our foundation formula requires political cooperation of a bipartisan nature to be updated.
The money from a $560 per student increase allows the district to restore many of the cut programs and teachers. The district plans to increase the pupil-to-teacher ratio by 1 across all grade levels instead of 4. Planned cuts to all middle school sports, high school hockey, gymnastics, swimming, and diving would also be reversed. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced yesterday that it will defund a program that catalogs sea ice data. As Shelby Herbert reports for the Alaska Desk, scientists say the program's termination could create a gap in climate research at a time when polar ice is dwindling to historic lows.
Rick Toman is a climate specialist at the Alaska Center for Climate Assessment and Policy in Fairbanks. He's taking a tour group past the International Arctic Research Center's Climate Stripes art installation. It's a long hallway at the University of Alaska Fairbanks covered with vertical stripes and a spectrum of blue and red.
Welcome to our Climate Stripes wall. Mm-hmm. So in good university fashion, how many people know what climate stripes are?
He says bluer stripes mean the temperature was cooler than the 100-plus year average, while shades of red mean warmer than average. At the end of the hallway, the stripes stop. Every year, from about 2000 till now, makes up a solid wall of scarlet. A guest asks, what changed? Toman says it's pretty simple. Less ice means higher temps.
So a lot of what's driving this is the collapse of sea ice, both decreased extent and the thinning of sea ice, and of course, increasing greenhouse gases.
That long-term Arctic temperature data is safe, but the United States' premier catalog of sea ice data isn't. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, is the federal organization that funds the Sea Ice Index, a program that monitors the long-term retreat of Arctic sea ice. NOAA announced earlier this week that it will decommission the program. That move is preceded by many other NOAA cutbacks this year. According to an internal budget document, the Trump administration is seeking to end nearly all climate research conducted by the agency. It also follows an Alaska Climate Research Center report that says Arctic sea ice has been at or near record low levels since December. Toman says the scientific community will mourn the loss of the sea ice index, which he uses for his own research all the time. He says he anticipated fresh ice data from the Bering, Chukchi, and Beaufort seas every single day.
And so we can track how things are changing and how it is now relative to last year or the year before or 30 years ago.
Hayo Eichen directs the International Arctic Research Center at UAF. He says the loss of the ice index might also greatly impact the lives and livelihoods of coastal Alaskans. For example, it could impede people's ability to determine the best time to schedule the barges that resupply communities off the road system.
All of that type of activity relies on the sea ice information that gives you a sense of what's normal, like what can we expect for a particular year.
Toman says other global sea ice monitoring programs, like those in Europe and Japan, could pick up the slack. But the loss of the NOAA-funded sea ice index, which he calls the gold standard, will sting.
So without this sea ice data, at least in the short term, people ask me, you know, what's the sea ice concentration look like in the Bering Sea? What's the ice extent now compared to last year? In the short term, the answer is going to be, we don't know.
NOAA officials did not respond to a request for comment by press time. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Shelby Herbert.
Anchorage residents generate a lot of trash, and the landfill where that trash goes will fill up in about 50 years. Anchorage officials are moving forward with a plan to free up space at the landfill by burning trash and harnessing that power into electricity for the city. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early has more.
Ian Goodwin has a long history with the Anchorage landfill. He's worked here for 25 years.
I got to bury both my elementary school and my junior high school here, by the way, because they demoed both of them. Apparently, we don't fix those buildings. We just demo them and build new ones, but I got to bury both of them. There was kind of some satisfaction there, if I'm honest.
It's a windy day at the landfill just north of town near Fort Richardson. Goodwin, now the superintendent of operations, is leading a tour, walking and driving on dirt paths that are covering up roughly 100 vertical feet of garbage. That's about a 10-story building. It's a lot of trash. Anchorage has been dumping its garbage here since the mid-80s. Goodwin says the average daily amount is roughly 1,000 tons, or 2 million pounds. He provides a visual for what that looks like monthly.
We bring in the BP building every month here, smash it up with that heavy equipment, and we cover it with dirt.
Now, the city of Anchorage wants to harness the power of this garbage to provide electricity for the community. The assembly recently gave the city the go-ahead to start looking at creating a mass burn waste-to-energy facility. It'd be the first of its kind in Alaska. Deputy Municipal Manager Mark Spafford lays out how it would work.
Similar to like a natural gas plant, but instead of burning natural gas, you're burning garbage that would otherwise go into the landfill. The garbage burns, it creates steam, it turns a turbine, and then the turbine could be, you know, there for generating power.
He says the result is a clean source of energy that has no shortage of fuel. Right now, Anchorage relies heavily on natural gas for electricity, powering about 80% of the grid, according to Spafford. But the region is facing a looming shortage of that natural gas, sending South Central Alaska leaders scrambling to find solutions. Spafford says the potential power generated from the 1,000 tons of trash Anchorage produces daily would be significant.
What that equates to is basically 20 to 30 megawatts of power that you could produce in a mass burn waste to energy process. And so that's anywhere, depending on who you ask, like 5 to 10% of the total base load of the power demands here in Anchorage.
And that's not the only problem a waste to energy project would fix. The landfill has a lifespan of roughly another 50 years, or about 200 more feet of garbage, Goodwin says. Not only would it be very hard to find another 300-acre parcel of land to build a new landfill, but Goodwin points to some homes on a nearby hill that could be impacted.
If it was 200 feet taller, the guys up on that hill over there, which, you know, I don't spend my time worrying about those guys, they'll be okay. But they won't be able to see the city anymore, because it'll be blocking the view.
Spafford says ideally, a waste-to-energy project would add 100 years to the landfill's lifespan. He says the project would likely take a while to complete as the city goes through things like designing and permitting, negotiating power purchase agreements, working with contractors, and figuring out how to pay for it.
What we're estimating is, you know, from today until, you know, power starts coming out of the facility, you know, anywhere between 6 to 10 years.
And at an estimated $500 million price tag, Spafford says public outreach will also be critical to getting the project up and running. If it's successful, he says the project could even serve as a means for cities and villages across the state to send in their trash, keeping their communities cleaner and helping keep the lights and heat on in Anchorage. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
The ice went out a week and a half ago in the 108-year-old Nenana Ice Classic, and coordinators think they will have the winners for this year's guessing game narrowed down by the end of this week. Whether it is one person or several who will win the $211,267 jackpot won't be known until a team of workers, who are sworn to secrecy, go through a painstaking hand-entry process. KUAC's Robin has more.
The cataloging of tickets in the Nenana Ice Classic is primarily done by hand. Manager Megan Baker says each ticket is tracked, those that sold and those that didn't, and each is checked several times by hand and on a database.
It's definitely a process that we've perfected over decades. It's unique and it takes time.
Baker says first the tickets, around 200,000 to 300,000 of them, each with a serial number, are collected from sellers around the state. Then they're sorted.
And we have anywhere between 70 to 100 employees that we have to hire each season to hand sort these tickets.
They're also checked for missing phone numbers or other errors, such as those with an April 31st date. Then they're organized by number and put into wooden cubbies.
Once we sort them, well, they have to be cubbied into serial numbers. So we have these wooden cubbies that we've had for decades. You know, my grandparents and my parents and my aunts and uncles have all used these same cubbies.
Baker says it's not just the cubbies that have lasted. A lot of people in Nenana have volunteered or worked for the Ice Classic over the years. They keep things pretty confidential until the winners are announced. And they're used to the process that takes a few weeks.
We type on these very old computers. It's a particular software that was written for us a very, very, very long time ago, in the late 80s, early 90s, and we use the same computers, but it works perfect for us.
Baker says each ticket is entered twice, so there's a check on spelling or time and date guesses. The database is printed and audited against the real tickets.
Those pages are printed, and then two people will come together. One person will look at the list that was printed, and one person will look at the actual ticket.
So with more than 200,000 tickets, you can understand how long this takes. The process goes on through the breakup of the Tanana River and the movement of the wooden tripod on the floating ice, which pulls a cable and stops the clock. And the ticket entry process continues after that. As you can imagine, there are a lot of people waiting for the announcement of the winners.
One of the individuals who believes they have a winning ticket call and leave a voice message, and they're like, we're going to go camping, and we just wanted to know, should we expect a phone call? And I can't confirm anything or deny anything until everything's entered.
The Nenana Ice Classic is a nonprofit. After paying all the employees and expenses, the board of directors figures what they'll give to charities. Each year, between $25,000 to $40,000 is spent on support for the local library, fire department, or senior center. Sometimes money is given to a family in need or to students for scholarships. Only after that does the jackpot get figured. This year's $211,267 pot is pretty close to last year's $210,000 award. The winning day is also the same as last year, April 27th. But Baker says it will probably be the end of this week before we know who are the winners who guess the clock would stop at 3:56 p.m. Alaska Standard Time. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Rhonda McBride and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Eric Stone in Juneau, Shelby Herbert and Robin in Fairbanks, and Ben Townsend in Nome. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.